to surrender it up, whatever it was. Well, hell, she'd always been wild and probably looked the perfect Halloween scare thing there on the stool with her matted hair and ashy legs and mouth crusty like something heaved up from the marshes.
I might have died,
she said aloud and shuddered, and it was totally unbelievable that she might be anywhere but there. She tried to look around, to take in the healer, the people circling her, the onlookers behind. But there were so many other things to look at closer at hand. The silvery tendrils that fluttered between her fingers, extending out like tiny webs of invisible thread. The strands that flowed from her to Minnie Ransom to faintly outlined witnesses by the windows. Doc Surge was studying the patient, watching the draping action of the rough white gown. He could do something with goods like that if he took hold of her right. She was studying the webbing, not certain she was fully conscious. How like the women in his stable years ago this woman was, women who studied themselves for some tangible measure of their allure, their specialness, but never quite knowing what it was. Money was the tangible evidence he offered of their attractiveness and his, their power and his, till they would do anything to keep his attention and his answers. He gave Obi's wife his full attention and hugged himself. Someone would have to work with Obi now. He would work with this one. He chuckled and waited for Minnie to be done, to bring the woman through this first phase, to release her, to hand her over. He'd have to handle it carefully and keep old Pharaoh well-leashed and under control. It would be like grabbing for the rails, and in grabbing, you had to be careful. If you caught the rail wrong, you couldn't get a foothold, and you might wind up with a bunch of hot cinders down your neck from the stacks. A bad grip and a small bump over the old bridge would dump you right in the drink. An abutment coming up, racing into view as the train turned the bend, the slats of the fence merely brushing your ass if you were lucky, crushing if you weren't. You could at least lose your hat. They used to toast him back of the barbershop. Were really toasting his hat. They called it the Magic Stetson, the kind of gray fedora Stagolee had killed Billy over. He'd been wise to get rid of it. Gone. There was nothing for his well-wishers to fasten onto in their need for legend and fable, nothing but what he hawked.
And that one crossed the street.
And the men would press in the doorway.
Got jaws on her pussy. That it make a dead man come.
The need for magic, for legend, for the extraordinary so big, the courage to pursue so small, they would crowd him and leave him no space to turn around in and change. Doc released his hold on himself and ran his hands over his hair. Later for hats, he chuckled to himself. There was work to do. What was Minnie fooling around about? The woman had come through already, it seemed. Doc plunged into a tomato handed him by one of the young nurses who always packed a lunch for these sessions. He smiled at her, at Minnie, at himself, widely showing all his wisdom teeth, the only thing displayed, not purchased, but well earned. Smiling because probing with his tongue the juicy flesh of the fruit and watching Obi's wife come alive in a new way and ready for training, he could do nothing else. Suddenly, there was a rumbling which, though slight, captured most of the people's attention because just at that moment the door to the hall opened. They expected to see a medicine cart being rolled in, or a laundry basket on the old-fashioned coasters, or a food truck loaded down with trays, its weight amplifying the wheel's trundle. Fred Holt walked in, mouth open and one finger up, ready to ask how come the odd numbers on that side of the hall ran out at 31. But when he stepped into the room and spotted the gangster fellow who was calling himself Doc Surge these days, and then, scanning the room, recognized the visitors who were looking at him in turn, checking their watches, frowning and turning away, he began to step back out. He'd expected a small office, a little desk, and a tidy nurse who would quietly direct him to room 37 for a checkup. His eyes weren't prepared for the expanse of the room or the crowd, and then it got dark, and he got worried. But it was only that he had bumped into the light panel on the wall, trying to exit. It took a minute to get it together. What with the storm-blackened world outside and the sudden loss of light, it was quite dark but for the glint of metal and the sheen of cloth. And it took another minute for him to notice that the object of everyone's attention was the pair of women near the window giving off all the light. One done up like a mummy in a shine-in-the-dark shawl, it looked like, the other a featherweight with 50 pounds of bracelets on. What the hell was going on? A seance or a jam session? What was going on? A couple of the doctors were trying to catch his eye with just that question. Prompt was one thing, but this bus driver was 2 hours early. He picked up his pace. It took one more minute to, one, flash the card the receptionist had given him by way of saying he was there on his own business, two, to regret having done that, for who wants to know that the driver about to take you on the highway at 55 miles per hour is a sick man, three, to figure out where he was and who was who. So this was the mojo lady he'd heard about. Kind of frisky looking, he thought. Seemed like she should have some old-looking clothes on, beat-up slippers, and look like a frog. He was working his way toward the front to take a good look when Doc Surge started toward him. Fred thought he was about to be thrown out of the room, but the doc fella was simply heading for the window to look out. Fistfuls of grit were being hurled against the panes, school kids horsing around in the yard, he figured. But something about the way Doc was looking out of the window told Fred it wasn't kids fooling around, but nature herself. Okay by him, it made more sense to get his checkup, grab a bite in the cafeteria if they had one, and hang around the place. Maybe meet this healing lady and kill a half hour or so until it was time to board the bus, than to try to stick to his original plan and get caught in a downpour. He noticed there was another door. It probably led to a hallway where he would find the rest of the odd numbers, at least room 37. Meanwhile, it felt okay to just be there. The longer he looked at the two women, especially the classy old broad, the better he felt. He glanced around the room, recognized a few familiar faces, riders, a neighbor, the boys from the barbershop. There was no one who looked like agitators or troublemakers to him. Porter had probably gotten that all wrong. It was beginning to raise sand out there, and Fred wondered if he'd closed the windows on the charter bus. If there was anything he could do without, it was a gritty seat and leaves down among the petals. After he saw a doctor, maybe he would stroll down that way and check things out. A brown-skinned girl in a green uniform, he noticed finally, was looking over his shoulder at the card he carried. Then she pointed toward the door at the other end of the room. So, he was being thrown out after all. She might have died, might have been struck by lightning where she sat, but then she might have died an infant gasping, but for my dear Sophie's holding hands. Might have drowned in her baptism gown, or legs wrapped round some strange man's head, too strange for repetition ever, holding on to his ears lest he make a sudden move, balancing more than weight on the pin of her spine, and thinking her heart would give out any minute, and not because the fucking and sucking was all that petite mort good, but because this weirdo she'd picked up in the library of all places kept lifting his head every other stroke, his breath reeking up at her over her trembling belly, to tell her what he was going to do to her, crazy things he was going to do with broom handle and vacuum hose as soon as he finished doing what he was doing to her, and how to pull away and get away and not be hurt. Who could tell what mad thing he was capable of, and of all things to be taking up precious space in her head where strategies needed to be laid out and studied, but some odd piece of lesson overheard in Madeir's class about the master brain being in the uterus, where all ideas sprung from and were nurtured and released to the lesser brain in the head, and damned if it didn't seem to be the case. She might have fried in that SRO hotel that terrible summer on the road when some two-timed bitter wife sloshed gasoline under the door. Not her door, but the door of a woman met on a march who wouldn't hear of Velma and the kids sitting up all night in the bus station or taking a chance in the churchyard with blankets, but gave Velma a key to her room and gave her to the nightmare wife cursing through the door and flinging a book of matches in the puddle. And no phone in the room, and the fire escape rickety, and the kids, no matter how they yanked and shoved and screamed, moving like they were underwater. And she was descending a rusty ladder that turned Lil James and Palma's girls red, wondering what sort of lesson this would turn out to be when her lungs cleared and her head cleared and the anger, smoke, rage, and soot gave her space to think and feel it through. Might have bled to death in the Coke machine area because emergency was full up and the head nurse was making it crystal clear that coloreds weren't serviced there. Trailing blood through the ambulance yard, her bundled slip pressed against her head that had been slam, slam, slammed hard against the concrete floor when a junkie going nuts had been tossed in the cell with the women demonstrators while someone in front counted out the money for the fine very slowly. But always there was a tug to come on, get up, move out, nudging her back toward life. Even standing by the open drawer in the kitchen, forgetting all she knew, even climbing into the oven, forgetting who she was tugged, was claimed. Move out. And the assistants lifted her on the litter and carried her out of doors to the straw mat in the courtyard where well-wishers could pass by and give advice, read signs, interpret, hand her medicaments fresh chopped from the bush to chew, fresh brought from the market to burn and inhale, fresh purchased from the apothecary to drink or swallow. And the ground rumbling as if a stone were being rolled away and someone reading that too. Velma, some lives ago, on the mat, on her back with feathers and bird bones and a sheet of painted bark spread over her. Voices droning. Readings. A crab had attacked a fisherman and held on or dropped off into the sand, meaning. A fig unripe had dropped from a tree and burst open, mud oozing, smelling like stink fish. Meaning, a mushroom cap toppling like a severed head, meaning, a wheel falling off its axis face down, meaning, and old Baron Sam clinking by looking for an invitation to sup. But the walkabout, marabout, coming sooner and sending the dancers, readers about their task, to dance, to leap about. They act the fish, then fly, and are the birds, tail in the air and fingers hunched under arms, they go monkey, dancing and loud, acting the medicine people who leap the healing circle and wait for what we run from, troubled. They act the sun, head, arms, hearts rich with recitation, and the word. They send a child to fetch Velma from her swoon and fetch a strong rope to bind the wind, to circle the world while they swell the sea with song. She is the child they sent. She is the song. Be calm. Minnie Ransom crooned, her words going out over Velma's hunched shoulder and into the room like warm hands caressing, staying, thunder shaking the room. And it was Pony, Daniel's twin, Poindexter, who took up the song, mouth wide open now and notes cutting through the gloom. Velma tried to hear it, couldn't hear it, but felt it press against her skin, pushing her back into the cocoon of the shawl where she died again. The gas lines. 6 blocks of enraged drivers lined up at the pumps and a well-wired time bomb, zombie-ized in the prison treatment center, turned into the streets running amok, or run down and trampled in the storming of the utility companies or the taking of the food sheds or the Pentagon. Dying in uniform when everyone not white, male, and of wealth is drafted to fight on foreign turf, but not for oil or diamonds or labor or markets, but for burial grounds. The bodies piled high near the borders of warring nations, bodies that cannot be cremated because of the smoke and the wind and the rain, and can't be buried because missiles would be heated up by the contamination and there is no room anymore underground, space taken up by equipment and uniform. Bodies that can't be launched into space anymore because NASA has long since gotten a reply and beings out there are sick of howdy doody and spinning satellites and Telstars and intrusive rocket probes and have made the terms clear. And can't be shipped for burial to Antarctica because the cemeteries heating up there have already melted the ice caps and tidal waves have inundated half the Earth. Might have been killed for the prize of her gumboots, mask, and bubble suit in the raid. The unrecognizable children who run the streets, taking over abandoned social service agencies and subways and concert halls and armories, finally taking her over too. Offspring of the children who roamed in vacant lots and city dumps years before, when old smoke detectors leached americium into the dirt, their clothes, their jeans. Kids who dug up for fun the contaminated uniforms and instruments, the abandoned uniforms of workers hunted by the angry mob awakened too late and misdirected in their hatred. Those kids grown up, twisted and wasted, giving birth to the ones shunned, turned out, driven off, who found each other and ran in packs and found her on the street, beat her down and snatched her protection, which would bring a high price on the open market. Lying there on her back, smaller than she'd been in years, lighter, feeling free, shoulders no longer bowed from the weight of the suit, nostrils stinging, breathing air strongly chemical, detergent, chlorine, and something faintly remembered from the generator in chem lab when she was a student many long years ago. And the stockaded compound too far to drag herself to, even though she was feeling this light. A pain in the center, and she jackknifes, waiting for the convulsions to begin. She cries out, but the children are moving off swiftly, the sucking sound of their spongy feet the only thing she hears. They leave gelatinous smears on the pavement and gluey smells where they'd stood, beating her down onto the ground that threatens to suck her under where she lies and twists. Her last glimpse is of something familiar, something from the old days when she was young, a slingshot in the pocket of one of the stompers. A forked stick jutting out like a willow switch that a water witch of old would use divining water, scanning the ground, dipping and nodding and finding what no geologist can find as quickly. A slingshot with which to shoot the 5 smooth stones against the forehead and penetrate the middle eye and pierce the veil. She is smiling on her back, staring at what used to be called sky. She had asked a simple enough question of her teacher. Why is God called the Alpha and Omega? And that triggered the alphabet lesson, 1 symbol a week. Madeir taught the alphabet in a way that made Mama May leave the room and shut the door. She couldn't remember why. The forked glyph whose vibe was holy to seekers. All Y had meant to her was the wishbone she and Palma tussled over, which always broke to no one's satisfaction. but lying there on her back, she was upright in the wet street, a babble of paths before her, but her choice made long ago. The fork in the road, the wishbone, the switch, the water witch wand, the slingshot, why bird? It was all the same, somehow. She did not regret the attack of the children. She regretted only as she lay on the straw mat, lay on the ground, pressed between the sacred rocks, lying on her back under the initiation knife at an age when the female element is circumcised from the boys and the male excised from the girls, regretted only as she moved the knife aside and the shiver ran from spine to crown and she bled and the elder packed cobwebs and mud that would not dam the gush and she bled on as she'd dreamt she would. Regretted, lying between the rocks and staring up at the clouds surrounding the moon, clouds so like the cauliflowers Mama May filled her lunch pail with. Clouds like wispy cotton snatched from dentists' dispensers, regretted that she would not get promoted to the next class to learn about the nature of life on Earth, and the human and spiritual purpose because the planet was plunging into darkness as she was twisting around toward the last of the light, her tongue probing her mouth for signs of breath, slapping around out of control and dripping open the serrated teeth till she was bleeding from everywhere. I'm getting a message. Minnie, yanking frantically at old wife's dress and grabbing air, her guide gone off to chapel at the critical moment. Minnie, moving quickly, pressing her tongue down hard away from her back molars. It was coming to her like a siren, not at all like instructions. A frequency not used before, more shrill than the signal from Saturn's rings, less timbre than the telling from the ring of wisdom, more static than the CBs or traffic waves. A wiry, shrill siren that spun in her head like a gyroscope. She was holding her jaws and heading toward the path, moving swiftly through the woods, not cloistered now at the crest by the sheltering branches, but thrown open, clear. Gliding over the lemongrass, damp against her legs, her shoes squishy like never before. She pauses merely to check the rainbow. It is not there, its colors absorbed by needy people, its vibes spiritualizing, soaked up, left faint, and toneless. She pulls down quickly the branch to finger the moist leaf, to drink from it and chew the leaf, trying to give herself pause to think, be calm, breathe in her surroundings. Old wife running up. Pentagon.
Say which? You mean like that thing you draw in the dirt with 5 points?
Pentagon.
Where's it at?
Old wife turning and casting suspicious glances. Lower left bicuspid, loud and clear, red alert.
That right?
Why didn't you tell me? Is this it?
What you mean, it?
Oh, hell, why am I wasting time with you? Minnie says, turning, wondering if there's time to race back, to appeal to the Loa who can short-circuit, engulf, misdirect an electric charge jumping from cloud to cloud, even as she stands there looking up at what should have been the rainbow. Why hadn't she given the sacred jugs and pots a really good sweetening with some baking soda and prepared something extra special for the Loa's festival? It was nothing to them to jump the clouds or swallow up the flash in a cloak for the asking.
And what makes you think it ain't them haints messing about with the electricity?
Not now, fool, not now.
You ain't got the sense you were born with, Minnie Ransom. Everything's all right. I'm with you.
Oh, my Lord!
Cora Ryder moaned before Anna Banks could say it. They clutched each other and grabbed at strangers, too. There was nothing soothing now about the singing. It was like the Phantom of the Opera and every other spooky movie she had ever seen. She wished the Daniels would quit. That was enough to shift the needle on the university's seismograph, Doc said, the hee-hee smothered in his throat, constricted with fear. The room was shaking, and Claiborne was nobody's California. Nadine held a chair and steadied herself. The baby, rushing from the front of her, had slammed into her back, turned, and was now shifting around, trying to distribute its weight. She closed her eyes and panted, 1, 2, 1, 2.
That was the kind of thunderbolt that knocked Saul off his steed and turned him into Paul, Cora said, releasing her friend to move toward the young girl and brace her.
This was no time to be fainting or going into labor, not when the good woman Ransom was so close to bringing her patient around. She walked the girl to a chair, carefully, but for all her caring and concern, Cora was busy checking calendar and clock, trying to calculate a 3-digit number she could box for the morrow. Years hence, she would remember that the beginning was not the payoff, not the beautician finally coming across with the money she had won, but was the moment Pony Daniels of the Circle raised his voice and sang about the time his dungeon shook and his chains fell off. Velma would remember it as the moment she started back toward life. The moment when the healer's hand had touched some vital spot and she was still trying to resist, still trying to think, what good did Wild do you? Since there was always some low-life, gruesome, gang-bang, raping, lawless, careless, pesty, last straw, nasty thing ready to pounce, put your total shit under arrest and crack your back, but couldn't. And years hence, she would laugh, remembering she'd thought that was an ordeal. She didn't know the half of it, of what awaited her in years to come. Fred Holt would remember that something happened to him, happened inside, something he knew no words for and would not attempt to describe until 6 years later, when his son was finally able to trace him to the resettlement center. He would remember the first part easily. He was in the chair, having his blood pressure taken for a final check, and thinking about going to the concert at the Regal, was thinking about the dude with the prison mouth, was grinding his teeth, cursing a certain dentist's soul, when lightning flashed and he found himself hunching down in the chair, bending to tie his laces, though they didn't need it. But he noticed the nurse was right down there with him, and they both laughed. And settling back in his seat, waiting to hear whether they wanted a urine sample or not, he thought he saw from the side street window Porter strolling out of Mount Shiloh Baptist Church, nonchalant about the rain, nonchalant about the fact that he was supposed to be dead. And he tried to fling open the window and shout while at the same time explaining to the nurse returning with his folder and the appointment card that he had to go that very instant. Then, racing to the door that led down the stairs to the side street, he took them two at a time and then he fell, falling in wet leaves that felt like dog shit underfoot. The picture of himself on his behind stayed in his mind for a long time. Falling and trying to get up and trying to run to the opening in the hedge to see as he'd seen from the room and to shout across the street, but when he got to the sidewalk, there was nothing, no one there. The wind dumped its cargo of paper bags, candy wrappers, and bus transfers, gritty and limp at the edge of the bus kiosk he ran toward finally when the downpour came. He stood there, not hearing the buzz and flutter of paper up against the plastic panes. Porter, in his last days, had acted just like that. Blasé, blasé, nonchalant, less and less concerned about the things so hard won. The day shift, his apartment lease, his grooming habits, his own ideas, even. It was as if Porter were detaching himself from his job, his surroundings, and from Fred, too, as if preparing himself for a new life. Fred Holt shot his eyes around him and whispered quietly,
"Porter, you there?"
A young couple in paper streamers dyeing red and green on their necks and arms ran into the shelter and smiled his way as they tried to dry each other off with tissues and damp hands.
"Kiosk,"
he muttered to himself for something to fix on, fingering a pencil in his left pants pocket, humming a song lest the couple think he was talking to himself. They were paying him no mind, were glancing up and down the block and then taking a deep breath before dashing across the street to cut through the infirmary yard, moving with a determination he would recall many years later when people raced across the borders to new frontiers. Campbell stood flattened against the service counter wall, looking first toward the round table where several men with rain-plastered hair tried to comb the whorls into some order, then looking toward the other big table where Jan and her stubby friend sat with the media women, passing around napkins and using the tablecloth to dry each other's faces. He wondered what effect the storm would have on the Brotherhood's pageant, on the Academy's procession, on the police's program, on the vigilante's plans, and on his future. Something more than storm was up, he figured, rejecting the idea that ordinary lightning, thunder, and rain could elicit so profound a response from everyone. They were doing a good job of play-acting. Just a storm. None of the conversations around him yielded anything he could use, but years ahead at blue ribbon panels and organized seminars, he would have occasion to say that the beginning was ushered in by an unusual storm. He wondered if the portable radio in the kitchen might inform him of similar storms in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world. He occupied himself by totaling checks and testing his memory. Was a comet due to appear anytime soon? Had a colliding asteroid been predicted? Was some country test blasting? Dr. Julius Meadows would say that it began on the stoop, listening to M1 and Thurston and their buddies talk about conditions at the plant. He would say that partway through the discussion, when the first rumble of thunder had been detected, listened to, called an explosion at the plant, and then discounted as weather merely, he'd taken time out to vow to give the Hippocratic Oath some political meaning in his life. He would describe at length the tavern they took him to, 5 grown men running through the streets, splashing in puddles like schoolboys, whooping and hollering, ducking into the place loud and raucous and being greeted by equally boisterous men, the rusty, ashy, scar-faced denizens of the neighborhood bar where it was certain one was wont to part another's hair with a chair on the slightest provocation, would describe how he helped to pass out flyers about the rally, would get up to show how the woman from the kitchen shook out the flyer he handed her as if to check for roaches, then smoothed the flyer against her breasts, pressing out the damp creases, and then took her time reading it as he ran the spiel as Thurston had. Would get sober and dignified, explaining that at that moment he understood that, talking about the health hazards at the plant, the woman leaning away from him as if to get a better view of the hole in his head or as if to avoid contagion, understood that, industrial arrogance and heedless technology was first and foremost a medical issue, a health issue, his domain. By the fall of 83, he would have taught himself that the reason they went to the Tip Inn Tavern was not to pass out leaflets or to scout up tickets to the Regal concert, but to set the scene for his conversion. By the winter of 83-84, while twisting around in his dentist's chair, pushing the metal arm away from his jaw and arguing that a second x-ray was not only not called for, but dangerous, Meadows would have earned a reputation among his colleagues for being a stickler about certain regulations, measures, obligations to the public. By the spring of 84, doing his taxes and checking the nuclear exemption clause in his insurance policy, he would have already queried Administrator B. Taliaferro Surge about a position at the Southwest Infirmary and sent an angry letter to the local TV station and gone on the air to say that the TB mobile units in the black community had screens that were longer than any others, long enough to cover the genitalia of youths coaxed into the trucks by lollipops, comic books, and free passes to the local discos. But none of it would really come together as a coherent and focused narrative until the summer of 84, when he lunched with Mrs. Sophie Haywood and Mrs. Janice Campbell and the man he'd come to call Doc, and heard the younger woman hold forth on what to expect now that Pluto had moved into Scorpio for a long spell. A planet of immense power, annihilation and transformation, the planet of complete and total change. And the older woman would ask him, flipping open the Bible, whether he understood the significance of certain tamperings with the script. The expressions about the second coming and Armageddon, for example. And he would shake his head no. It had been years since he'd had occasion to even look at a Bible, except to move it from the phone table in the hotels to a drawer. Should be translated Presence of Christ and New Age, not. And Doc would catch his eye and wink, two men humoring the women. It was the first crack of lightning and thunder that made Palma duck into the shelter of Marcus Hamden, and he held her and held too the weight for her, her dread, annoyance, and now alarm. Standing by the flat truck, watching for a minute the young academy boys, serious and efficient with the unloading of chairs and tables, they then straightened and began combing the park with their eyes. A few people were scurrying for cover under the trees, older folks snapping out their newspapers in preparation for tent hats, but most of the early arrivers to the park simply strolled about, hailing friends, groups of brothers eyeing the sisters, groups of sisters eyeing the brothers, children fussing at kites that would not get up off the ground. There were a lot of people, considering the early hour. Young men bopping by, yards of leather strung across, back and over shoulders to hold tool-worked cases so small that keys and cigarette packs peeped out. Magenta, lime, copper-colored shirts unbuttoned to the belt, thin gold chains at the throat and a buddy cracking, "Man, why don't you comb that nappy chest?" and folks falling out. Sisters with beaded braids swinging as they sashayed toward the band shell where the food booths were setting up, moving over pebbles and scraggly grass on pencil-thin heels or clumpy wedges. Vendors unpacking sacks and boxes of flashlights, candles, Darth Vader laser sticks, maracas, 8-track tapes, film, banners, straw hats, fans. Folks walking along with trays strapped around their necks selling bags of peanuts, leaning in closely to this or that one selling bags of pot. Incense bundles in tinfoil, Coke in tinfoil packets, the balloon man, a fat youth in clown white juggling baseballs, an old man with a risque talking dummy on his knee drawing a crowd toward the benches. Portable radios, TVs, phonographs with Ashford and Simpson, Don't Cost You Nothing, vying with Peaches and Herb, Roberta and Donnie, kiddie shows, news reports. Two bloods in skinny black clothes, derbies and bright yellow suspenders, skate dancing on a patch of cement near the bandshell, the crowd predicting how hip the Olympics'll be once black folks take over the ice competitions and then introduce the art of roller skate dancing to the world. Drummers in dreads and knitted caps, beards, sandals with cowbells and chukaras working out on the hill. Women slumming from the heights, jiggling about, twitching to take their clothes off, settling for a Veronica or two of their disco skirts, mistaking the parkies ducking past to clear the trees for playmates. The wino couple from Palma's old neighborhood holding each other up, eggshell stepping with their cups and brown paper sacks, managing to make it to the flat truck to sit down, smoothing down each other's clothes, each other's stringy, grease-waved hair. The kind of hair Palma and Velma had called good hair, until Mama May explained the alcohol source of the waves. Looking up and answering bleary-eyed and incoherent that no, they hadn't seen Velma and didn't have a clue as to who Palma could possibly be.
Should we wait here?
Marcus was looking for a way for them to sit down comfortably. It seemed a sensible enough suggestion to her. Eventually, everyone came to the drums, and cars and trucks were arriving already with the master drummers and dancers from the back districts. No matter where Velma was, she'd hear the drums and come to the park. Palma had her mouth open to say, yes, when the rumble of thunder took hold of the park, arrested everybody in their tracks. Marcus staring down at the ground as if waiting for it to crack wide open. And still the lightning had not finished, was still blinking, stuttering, as though it meant to stay on forever once it took hold. And they would have occasion soon, and then way into the future too, to decode the look that passed between them the moment Marcus lifted his eyes and his mouth fell open, and Palma dropped her eyes from the sky and moaned. Obi had been bobbing around in the whirlpool when the thunder struck, shaking the building. Bobbing around in the swirling waters, breathing along with the water's pulse, with the pumping jets that throbbed against the back of his shoulders and the soles of his feet. Trying to maintain equilibrium, trying to find a balance between the longing for clarity and the dread of finding too great a challenge of reunion. His body too far down in the hot water one minute, and slippery as he was from the massage oil, slippery as his elbows were hooked on the rim of the pool, he could go under. His torso buoying up the next minute, the front of his body out of the water, not getting the benefit of heat and the forced currents. He'd been thinking of blueprints, the blue waxy kind with scraped white lines, trying to coax his subconscious to surrender the plan, to surface, take over, and reveal something he knew he must know to pull it all together, but dodging it too. Legs and feet floating gently to surface, his hands flat against the water's green, the plan floating up to the threshold of consciousness and the knotty problem coming loose in his muscles, his joints, his brain. Then the building shook, and he opened his eyes in a daze, staring at the lumpish green and gray on his right ankle, the elastic with the locker key on it, but still not awake. Not even with the pandemonium breaking around him, yearning and premonition still washing through him as his pool mates hustled themselves out of the water, some heaving themselves over the sides of the pool, sending waves against him. And he watched, as in a dream or dozing in the movies, some pulling up on the hooped rails of the steps, kicking spray in his face, others leaping clean out of the water as flying fish, as if ejected by the water's jets.
Hey, Obi, somebody wants you.
A wonderful message or not in his ears, at the back of his head, swarming through him. Velma wanted him. The folks wanted him. His brother Roland wanted him. And oh, did the cops want him. Thunder rumbling up from the bottom, trembling the water, shooting through him and showers blasting full force, then shut off abruptly, doors banging and brothers dripping and stumbling about in clouds of fog and steam. Talking loud and flamboyant in defiance of whatever the interruption in their ablutions meant. He didn't realize how close he was to believing it dream, to falling back to sleep in the water's heat, till he felt a hand on his arm. and he came more fully awake to the white toweled figures moving along the black rubber mat walkway in a pileup, brothers streaming out of the sauna, the steam room, the alcove where the mirrors and hair dryers and shavers were, exchanging notes and extravagant bravado and flat facts about the dimming or flickering of lights in various parts of the spa.
Phone call, oboe.
He was disoriented still, trying to turn in the water to take in the moon face looming over him. Ahiro, down on his haunches, blue kimono sleeves dipping into the puddles beyond the rim of the pool. Obi was breathing along with the flickering lights, stuttering, stuttering. Longing and fear like the ebb and flow of the water, the intake and outtake of breath, the doo-a-doo-a of a group of singers huddled in the alcove door to sing down the thunder, the ripple of green to and fro across the forehead of the monsieur, his friend, the messenger of strange tidings. Phone call. A smooth brown leg with bunched calves stretching out for balance and an arm extended to pull him up. And now he was turning over and over in the pool, his elbows digging into the tiles, scraped raw and bleeding. Phone call. Was someone calling to say Roland was dead, had escaped, had a hostage by the throat demanding to see him? Said to come to the infirmary. Sounded important. Lifting out like a weightless fish, his scales, his flesh oozing away from his bones, dropping down into the waters, releasing him. You okay, oboe? He padded across the tiles, tucking his towel, squeezing his hair, popping water from his ears, fighting to come awake. Velma. Ahiro trotting along beside him on the rubber mat, his zoris squishing splat splat, so Obi breathed along with that. As good a rhythm as any. You okay now? Nodding, going through the doorway to the locker room, a shift in climate, a drop in temperature, a sudden quiet. The brothers had bypassed the clothes locker in favor of the lounge, where phones and light and vending machines and other signs of civilization assured them. He was still damp inside his clothes, his shirt smack against his back, when he hit the stoop and met the wind and the downpour. Motorcycles were skidding down the hill, shredding kites and flyers and brown paper bag masks. Panel trucks were pausing in the traffic while young boys climbed out of the cabs to get to the back, flinging jackets and newspapers over the drums and horns. Trees were littered with leaflets, a young girl in dazzling orange harness directing school children at the crossing, an old man caught in the middle of traffic looking for a break to make a dash. Obi was rocking on the top step, dread welling up as the curbs overflowed. Velma. The rain's music more insistent than the drumming sounding from across the way.
Obi? Obi. Hey, my man. What it is?
Someone shouting from a van stuck in mid-descent from the heights. Someone who called to him from a bullhorn of rolled-up newspaper getting limp and soggy, then pulled in the window. But the arm remained, and the hand gestured upward as if this were a sensible traffic sign to the taxis and bikes behind, taking a turn for the up. And Obi remembered Sonny and Graham were on security. So he looked up, searching the windows of the rooming house where surveillance had been rumored. Young Bobby had sworn he'd caught the glint of binoculars on two occasions. The suspect window, empty. The tops of buildings lost in the fog. The Regal's dome, faintly gold in the purple-gray patches of clouds smeared across the buildings. Several students, who'd bunched up behind him on the academy steps, broke past him to jump on the back of trucks painted for carnival, smeared and running red, green, black in the streets. And he wondered what the hell he was waiting for. Someone had called from the infirmary, and there he was, watching the kids scramble on board, throwing satin jackets over the drums and each other's heads, yanking yards of plastic from the cleaners out of a sack and tearing off lengths and passing them around. Rocking on the top step, vestigial wings twitching, the drums sounding from the studios unsmothered and loud, the wind heaving newspapers against his pants legs, the wind blowing plastic into one youth's face and both becoming odd beings sent to Earth at the moment, encased and then peeled, to walk among the people as kin and bring them through the passage.
OB, come on, man. Rain or no rain, it's time.
Later. His voice, like a foghorn, his legs rubbery as he dashed into the streets, his cuffs full of water. And he would remember in the days ahead how the look of a particular Chevy grille, a Ford truck fender, an Alabama license plate, the treads of a Goodrich tire made him pause, stare, forget he was in a hurry. Pause in the middle of the double yellow lines. Thinking about the face sucking in plastic, featureless, looking at the old man there in the street hugging a lumpy hanky, rain streaming down his face, featureless. Paused, but not because of the traffic or the rain or the odd notions creeping through his brain about alien beings or the dim memory in the shoulder blades of wings and the flight long ago and the instructions, but an eye. There was an eye poised on him, an energy focused on him from somewhere, an eye clarifying him, arresting him.
I'd run for shelter if I knew which way to run, the old man shrugged with an apologetic grin.
The academy's open,
breaking the spell.
Coffee in the lounge,
he pointed,
and hot soup.
He was going to turn, halt the traffic from the heights and escort the elder by the elbow. Safe passage. But he was caught again in the beam of the eye, fixed. And again he looked toward the window young Bobby had pointed out, trying to pierce the fog, water splashing his eyes to a squint. A flock of birds were banking sharply over the rooming house to avoid the Regal's dome, the rear guard dragging away a cloud of dark purple.
You're welcome at the academy,
he mumbled, the words trailing away. The elder had already found a break in traffic and was broken field trotting toward the curb. Released again, he made for the side lot, the shortcut to the infirmary, no longer hunching his shoulders and crowding himself slender through the downpour. He walked stiffly, expectant. He was breathing shallowly, any minute, a bullet. And then he was in the safety of the movie house's shadows, the pavement going earth underfoot, an embrace of tree smells, new leaves, and the infirmary yard's odd mix of odors. Creosote, mildew, rot, tree mold, and two, the fragrance of newly turned earth, the sweet of sap, sap rising to renew, but activating the mold, too, as if there were no way around it.
Brother Obia, what's going on?
The young brothers who normally posted themselves on the walls that kept the woods out and the yard neat were huddled in the doorway of the generator shed. Several girls behind them, peeking out over shoulders or between triangle arms made with pockets, peeking out at the rain, out at the oily rainbows in the puddles of dirt, others holding their noses and making beat-em-in-the-head gestures at the backs of two winos pissing against the stage door of the Regal.
Looks like everything's going on.
Obi shrugged, slowing and then moving on. Two girls shared a look and sucked their teeth, clearly disappointed by the dull response from the legendary man of the academy.
The doings rained out, or what?
The same two, exchanging looks with lifted brows, their own group's wordsmith, a turkey, too. There were nods and shrugs and dumb show as everyone looked up at the sky, the two critics leaning out over the shoulders of their boyfriends to spot the birds tearing past the Regal, taking the clouds with them and letting a little gold shine down for a moment. It was an odd silence. This silence before the blanket of gray silver needles that was the rain, its music monotonous and nothing clever being said. And Obi passed the sheds, remarking to himself that silence was not the way. These word wizards, these say-smart sorcerers, masters of metaphorical coinage that kept the language of the district vibrant and new, mute. No memorable quotes, no gnomo notes to remember later, to give shape and punctuation to the tale he would tell in the days ahead, the where were you when it began response. And over his shoulder he followed the trail of their eyes toward the stage door, as if backstage in the regal was the answer, the word. As a child, he'd learned there in the wings how the cards were marked, where the rabbit was stashed, how the swallowed sword collapsed, of what the boldness of the jazz musicians consisted. He'd learned all that in the days when they'd tried to revive the regal, revive vaudeville, give the local talent a play. And now the young folk stared out through the rain as if getting past the splattered glass, the wine bottles, the smelly old men, the rusted lock on the stage door. They'd find out where the fingers go in the back of the head, the back of the eyes, to make talk come out.
Oh, God.
The girls were moaning in chorus, grabbing arms and jackets and pushing their backs against the shed's door while lightning was panting somewhere on the far side of the woods.
Holy shit, the ground's moving.
Cut it out.
I ain't playing. Can't you feel it? Fucking earthquake.
Quit it, Bo Peep. I mean it now.
He almost made it to the back door, slipping on the wet leaves piled high and covering the bottom step. He almost made it, slipping, reaching for the knob, his shoes soaked and sluggish.
Velma? Velma!
Welling up in his throat, stretching toward the door and a pulling in his side, ducking to escape whatever it was thundering toward him, breathing along in gasps with the tree's roots down to darkness, branches up to light, the building holding its breath, standing against the thunder coming. Then everything went phosphorescent and he fell, stripped by lightning, gold splashing in the granite's dents before the door. One shoe lost, and all the faith and courage that had been holding him up, gone, and the challenge of reunion flooded away, and the dread of the moment and moments ago soaked to mush, his pants torn, and his knee bleeding. Stripped by lightning, he would say in the days ahead, his flesh fallen away, and nothing there on the back step. But his soul, with the stark impress of all the work done and yet to do, all the changes gone through and yet to come, all the longing and apprehension as he'd watch human beings becoming something else, and wondering what it had been like for the ancestors watching the first wheel be rolled down the road. On the back steps, fixed, the damp of mildew jamming up his nose, the damp of new earth turned and waiting, trying to free his lungs, the knob just out of reach of his hand, sliding down the door with the rain.
Get on up, brother.
A command at his back, and the giggle of two young girls imitated, then hushed, and he couldn't. His legs shot. His ankle sprained, his knee bleeding, his elbows sore, the breath knocked out of him in the fall. Couldn't get up, and so he did get up. Got up as a switch was thrown, and the couples jumped from the shed door, then returned laughing, the hum of the generator sudden and soothing for no reason any of the wordsmiths could capture in a name. And he saluted them in a daze, the sky opening and the regal releasing molten gold into the fog, the drums sounding in a playoff with the thunder, saluted the future, gold splashing in his eyes. The lady in the chair is rising damp, but replenished like the lady rising from the sea. The drums are still calling from the building across the way, answered ragged and indistinct by drums in the distance. Rain is pelting Doc's windows and the curtains blowing out, then folding in damp. Sophie looks out, wondering if she'd left the bedroom window at home opened, wondering if her costume hanging from the drapery rod is safe. The rush and stampede for shelter from nature created the wind. She watched the wind, whipping curtains out of buildings, white and pink and yellow spirit arms signaling. Had Velma found herself? Fear and dread at the unspeakable level puts thunder in the air. The zigzag strike between the clouds crackling down. Would Velma find an old snakeskin on the stool? The sky is lit by tomorrow's memory lamp. Slate rained clean, a blessing. At least a 24-hour delay. Respite, a blessing. 24 more hours to try and pull more closely together the two camps of adepts still wary of the other's way. Causes and issues, they're vibrating at the mundane level. Spirit this and psychic that, escapism, irresponsible given the objective conditions. Rain, delay, new possibilities in formation, a new configuration to move with. A flood one moment in time could drown the earth, the next create fish farms in the deserts. The wind that lifts everything up this minute used to bury it all in the sand last time. Children streaming past the window on skateboards, bikes, skates, on foot. Balloons spotted, kites limp, masks dangling from their cords and trailing behind like the kites won't. With masks, it was the same. A plaything or a summons, be a fool or become a god. Timing was all and everything in time. Sophie leaned against the sill and squinted into the streets, alive with so much more than she was able to see yet. But in time, she counseled. Once Minnie brought Velma through, perhaps the girl at last would be ready for training. She'd waited a long time for the godchild's gift to unfold. Had had long periods of doubt that what she'd sensed that first meeting, the infant sliding easily into her hands, was actual, read correctly, and not just the product of an overworked imagination of a godmother too serious about her role, her calling. But there'd been signs and times in church, in the attic, in the woods, when Velma had started, gone mute, stared, become very still, that renewed the notion and Sophie'd thought, maybe. Maybe. And while the girl had never shared what she was seeing, experiencing, was no doubt rejecting before it could imprint on the mind, Sophie waited. Waited now, adjusting her hat and pulling the damp dress away from her legs. She'd missed seeing what was happening to Velma, the woman, had not been attentive, gotten blocked, sidetracked. But what had driven Velma into the oven, Sophie was certain now, was nothing compared to what awaited her, was to come. Once Minnie opened her up and welcomed her back anew, renewed, Velma would begin to see what she'd been blind to, what Sophie herself was blind to, but knew. Of course, she would fight it. Velma was a fighter. Of course, she would reject what could not be explained in terms of words, notes, numbers, or those other systems whose roots had been driven far underground. Sophie vowed to concentrate more fully and stay alert and be at hand, for Velma's next trial might lead to an act far more devastating than striking out at the body or swallowing gas. It was clear the downpour was no spring shower, that she'd been given time to finish fasting and the silence. Sophie pressed her forehead against the cool of the glass and gazed out. Choices were being tossed into the street like dice, like shells, like cola nuts, like jackstones.
Each happening for weal or woe can...
I don't want to hear that. The Henry gal's coming through with more than I can handle at the moment. Now, what about the Pentagon message I got which nearly split my head?
Not yet, you didn't.
What you telling me? That my jaws don't ache? That my teeth ain't knocking their knees together? Speak plain, woman. This child is creeping around, hunting for pain, and when she's satisfied it ain't there, she's gonna start bumping into other things that are, and I ain't ready. Now, am I having a flash forward, or am I getting as batty as you?
Like you always say, men, everything in time.
None of this ain't happened yet. Some of this is happening now. All of this is going on, but I ain't here. All of the above? None of the above? Will you at least tell me, is it raining or not?
I'm here to help with the patient, men.
Don't hand me no some such about division of labor at a time like this.
Gonna be a long night, men.
Minnie Ransom, sighing. She knows it'll be a long afternoon and a longer, even, night. The kind of night that drives men of the heights out of doors, crazed and into the district on the prowl, searching out disaster.
To jerk off? Like at a lynching,
Doc would say. The kind of night when women of the district check and recheck the covers of the sleeping kids and hope that if the footfalls on the creaky stairs are not their men, then pray they're with some other woman safe.
Gonna let me wrestle by myself, huh? You always were a stubborn, weird, old, smelly witch. You know it?
But, men, that's how I choose to manifest myself this time.
Minnie Ransom, staring, her hands sliding off the shoulders of silk, the patient turning smoothly on the stool, head thrown back about to shout, to laugh, to sing. No need of Minnie's hands now. That is clear. Velma's glow aglow. And 2 yards wide of clear and unstreaked white and yellow, her eyes scanning the air surrounding Minnie, then examining her own hands, fingers stretched and radiant. No need of Minnie's hands now, so the healer withdraws them, drops them in her lap, just as Velma, rising on steady legs, throws off the shawl that drops down on the stool, a burst cocoon. This concludes The Salt Eaters by Tony Cade Bambara. Narrated by Mia Ellis. Copyright 1980 by Tony Cade Bambara. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Karma Smith, on behalf of the estate of Tony Cade Bambara, and was produced in the year 2022 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.